Hear ye. The Supreme Court of the State of Wisconsin is now in session. Your silence is commanded.
Please be seated. Well, we're delighted to welcome you all to the first oral argument of the September 2007 to August 31, 2008 non-existent Supreme Court term. We refer to it as a term, although, as you all know, the court's in session all the time. Let me first I'm going to tell you there's a fire alarm testing at 11 a.m. It would be fortuitous if there was both a fire and a fire alarm testing at the same time, so I think that's not a high risk. So we will stop proceedings, but we will not evacuate the building. Okay? Second thing I want to do is introduce the court to you all. And I will start on my far left with the newest member of our court, Justice Annette Ziegler. Sitting next to Justice Ziegler is Justice Patience Robinsack. To my immediate left is Justice Patrick Crooks. I'm Shirley Abrahamson, the Chief Justice, and will be in a state of confusion since all the justices have shifted places on the bench except me. So to my right is Justice Ann Walsh Bradley. To her right, Justice David Prosser. And on the far right, Justice Lewis Butler. With those introductions made, I will call our first case, which is 2005 AP 886. Robert Stewart versus Weisflog Showroom Gallery, Inc. Arguing on behalf of Weisflog Showroom Gallery, Inc. and Mr. Weisflog is James A. Ratzel. That will be 20 minutes. 5 minutes, Ms. Attorney Lori M. Lubinsky will argue for the Wisconsin Builders Association, an amicus. And then Roy Wagner will be arguing on behalf of the Stewarts. And then, Mr. Ratzel, you will have 5 minutes in rebuttal. Is that the correct statement of the appearances? Fine. Attorney Ratzel.
Please, the court. My name is Jim Ratzel, and I represent Weisflog Showroom Gallery and Ron Weisflog. In its simplest form, this case is about preserving the jury verdict. If you look at all the nuances of this case, the jury did exactly what the law and what the Home Improvement Act wanted the jury to do. If you look at what the jury did, this case is very logical and makes sense. The jury heard all of the evidence. They heard the arguments about the damages due to misrepresentation, they heard about the bad construction. They heard about the claims against the individual, they heard about the claims against the business. They were given a rather extensive verdict. Now, as this court is familiar, not every verdict is perfect, and anyone in hindsight could go through a verdict and say, well, better wording should have been used here or there. But what the jury did was important and must be supported. The troubling aspect of the Court of Appeals decision is the court indicates, in our quote from the court's decision, we see no place in this framework for apportioning damages, whereas here the damages flowed from the initial misrepresentation. That wasn't found by the jury. The jury heard the damages due to misrepresentation. They heard about the alleged deceptive practices. They also heard about bad construction. And the jury was essentially told, you have to decide what damages flowed from the misrepresentation, what flowed was simply bad construction. This court is going to issue a decision which is going to be looked upon by other courts and juries in the future as a guide in terms of how do we handle this type of claim on a home construction site.
Counsel, if I can ask you a question about the special verdict. I'm looking, and just in response to your argument, at 16A that talks about what sum of money, if any, will fairly and reasonably compensate Robert and Lynn Stewart for damages resulting from the negligence of the defendants. When I look at 16, I don't see anywhere in there where there's a separate section that would allow for damages arising from the misrepresentation. Where does that come in the special verdict?
The verdict is broken up on, and you have the right portion of the verdict. The verdict is separated out with two questions for 16. The first one, 16B, says misrepresentation. Now, I agree with you. The 16A just talks in terms of a dollar figure. The jury literally was given a laundry list of different problems and said, how much is it going to cost to fix this project? As a matter of fact, in my opening argument, I even told the jury, fix this house. So that was not even really in dispute. They literally were presented with about $120,000 worth of damages. They inserted the figure of $95,000. That's within their discretion. But the important aspect
that,
is
what... That is, I just want to make sure I understand. That was for the negligence, correct?
No, that's literally what are the... Well, it says the negligence of the defendants, but I think that fairly read, that represents all of the damages.
And the reason I'm asking the question is there's a couple of things that I'm not quite sure that the special verdict addresses. One deals with the ATCP claim, and the other deals with the negligence in design, which is not even part of 16B.
I agree with you, and I think all counsel that participate in the trial that are now before you would probably agree that at the time this was being crafted, we all had different ideas and proposals, and the judge literally took all of our ideas and said, this is probably the best way to get this across. I agree with you, Justice. It can be more artfully crafted. But I think when you look and see really what the jury heard, they heard all the evidence, they were able to, the figure is clearly right in the realm of a figure for the total damage to the house. You know, there were estimates that it would cost anywhere from, my memory is correct, anywhere from $60,000 to $90,000, and then there were miscellaneous items. So the jury clearly understood what they were doing. The significant portion is on 16B, where they are told, all right, now you have to separate out those damages actually due to the misrepresentation. That's the Home Improvement Act, as opposed to those damages that's simply bad work. And this is borne out when you consider examples of what the jury heard. There was a floor joist, and I cited it in the brief, in this hot tub room.
Counsel, before you get to that, it is apparent to me that you're sensitive that 16, both A and B, are problematic in their wording. That's a gentle way of saying it. It's apparent to me because you led with your right. You started out with your argument. You know, you weren't in 30 seconds and said, no special verdict, wording is perfect, you know. So, you know, you know where you're going and you know where a weakness is. My problem is it's not good. It's bad. And what do we do about it in the context of this case? It's bad because 16A only asks for damages for negligence. If you look at the special verdict, of course, you have the first three questions that dealt with 110 misrepresentation. And question three says, was that misrepresentation a cause of the damages? And question 15 looks at misrepresentation, a 110 violation, with regard to the remodeling contract. And it says, what damages did this misrepresentation cause? Was it a cause of damages? The jury said yes. And so then you would expect 16A to include those damages, but it doesn't. It just includes the negligence, which were the subject of other questions in the verdict. So what do we do with that when it's on its face, it's problematic?
I think what you do is you look at the entire case history. And I think what you will find is if the jury was confused, when they got to 16B and say misrepresentation, they would have sent a question out saying a percentage of what? Otherwise, the jury knew what they were dealing with. They knew what the damages were, and that was $95,000.
Well, I, you know, resulting from the negligence. Negligence is a pretty clear word there, and of course you have questions 7, 8, 9 dealing with negligence, questions 11, 12, and dealing with negligence. The other questions deal with misrepresentation. They were only asked for total damages regarding negligence. Then we get to 16B, and it's the problem that Justice Butler pointed out. Then they're only asked about negligence in construction. What happened to negligence in design, which was question 8 that they answered in the jury, that the negligence in design was a cause of damages? I mean, this is a little messy.
It can be messy, but I think you have to protect the fact that this jury tried very hard and they properly separated out those damages due to misrepresentation from those damages due to construction.
Well, let me ask, what percentage, since the jury found in question 8 that with regard to negligence in design, that negligence in design was a cause of damages to the Stewarts, what amount of money did the jury award for that finding, that the negligence in design was a cause of their damages? What percentage was attributed to the negligence in design from their answer to question 8?
The jury did not split it up any further than those two important divisions, one of which is negligence in construction. That incorporates any and all negligence associated with that project.
Well, negligence in construction was answered in 11 and 12. I mean, I want to say, come on, you can see that. Was the remodeling contract negligent with regard to the construction? Question 11. 12, was the negligence a cause, that negligence in construction a cause? So they answered the question. There was a specific question regarding negligence in construction, a specific question regarding negligence in design. The special verdict only asked for negligence in construction. You got a problem. What should we do with it?
I think what you have to do, if anything, when you remand it back, if you want to remand it back, you still have to preserve the separation between the misrepresentation and the negligence construction, and you have if you want to carve out and have a limited trial on the negligence and construction aspects, you can do that, but that gets to the argument of the statute of limitations. I would contend the discussion we're having may be germane for future issues in future cases. As it pertains to this case, those claims are barred by the statute of limitations, so the important thing is to preserve that 20.
A moment.
I'm sorry.
As I understand it, you really read 16A, what sum of money, if any, will fairly and reasonably compensate the Stewarts for damages resulting from the negligence? You may read that as damages resulting from the negligence and misrepresentation of the defendant.
Right.
That's the way you read it.
It's a catch-all damage thing.
All right. Now, my next question to you is, before we move on, was there evidence of more than $95,000 total damage that the plaintiffs were claiming? Okay. So, if there was more than $95,000 claimed here by the plaintiffs, that raises a different issue. I had hoped you would say, no, all the evidence was $95,000, so it doesn't matter what the question was because the jury was giving them all the damage that they asked for. So, okay, ends that argument.
But that shows again how hard this jury worked and the importance of preserving.
We don't know what it shows.
Wasn't the $95,000 the first figure that came in by their expert witness, and then he did a supplemental information to add on to that $95,000, which brought it higher than $95,000? But the first was essentially $95,000 and a few odd dollars.
I think you are correct. It's around the 90s there.
Okay, but there was evidence of more. That's the only thing I'm
raising
here.
The total damage claim, and I'm sure Attorney Wagner can testify to it, is probably around $120,000.
Okay. All right. Now, I was surprised you led with that because it seemed to me you want the damages to be zero and you don't want to defend this jury verdict at all.
I want the damages to be zero, but I also respect what the jury does in a case. And the jury has told my client,
if you don't get zero, then the next best thing is 25%. That's what your argument is, right?
No, I think it's important that you respect what the jury did, which my client does. Even though we may disagree with what the jury did, we respect and recognize the verdict. However, what I'm concerned with is the Court of Appeals has said, you know those damages of 25%? It's actually all flows from it. It's much like in a liability, an auto accident case, where the jury were to say the defendant's 35% at fault. The Court of Appeals says, no, we think it's 65%. And I would respectfully argue that's the problem with this case, and that's going to be a problem for future cases that are going to be looking at this one, is you now have a Court of Appeals that has said on its own, we're going to disregard what the jury did and make our own determination of what the damages flowed from, plus we're not going to put a logical stopping point on it. And that's going to be problematic.
Isn't the Court of Appeals saying, in effect, that the language of the regulation or the statute is because of, in that this that the damages here were because of the misrepresentation and that they're not apportionable. The concept of multiple causes not being apportionable is not new in tort law. Right?
I agree. And that's what the Court of Appeals has said, but I would respectfully contend that's the question for the jury in terms of what damages reasonably flow from the misrepresentation.
Well, you see, they didn't ask that question.
Pardon me?
That's the problem. 16A doesn't ask that question.
Fortunately, 16B does. And because we have a jury making the determination of what damages flow from the misrepresentation, what damages flow from just poor workmanship, we have to support that. And I'll go to my example with the joists. There was no misrepresentation involved in putting these floor joists in. The plan said you have to have double joists. You have some poor worker that did a bad job putting in a single joist. That's not a question of misrepresentation. That's poor workmanship. There were a lot of examples like that, and that's why the jury separated that out. And more importantly, that's why the Court of Appeals can't separate it out. That's a question for the jury. Look at the problems that will develop if the Court of Appeals rationale stands. You will have legitimate contractors on a site, a major remodeling project like this one. This one was $200,000+. Most of it turned out very well. A legitimate contractor could come on the site and the homeowner will say, will you do a good job for me? The contractor says, yes, I will. Ultimately, on every construction site, there's punch list items. After the construction's done and there's punch list items, the homeowner says, you misrepresented. You were going to do a good job for me. And now I get all these punch list items doubled, plus I get actual attorney's fees. The problem with that is this hypothetical good contractor, what if he brings a plumbing contractor on the site, an equally solid corporate citizen plumbing contractor? While he's doing the plumbing, a pipe breaks due to poor manufacturing of the pipe. The homeowner can sit there and say, since that original contractor said he would do a good job, now I get all my damages from the water from the burst pipe doubled, even though everyone in this transaction is a viable and proper citizen. That was not the intent of the Home Improvement Act. The Home Improvement Act was to go after the unscrupulous contractor, the bait-and-switch individual, the guy driving around the neighborhood saying, I'll put new windows on your house, you give him money, and suddenly he doesn't put the good windows, he gives you bad windows. That's the focus of the Home Improvement Act, and as a result, the damages must be limited to those damages that flow from the misrepresentation. The Home Improvement Act was never intended to replace simple claims for breach of contract or poor workmanship. That has been around forever. Those suits are constantly brought, and the public is well served by breach of contract claims.
Counsel, let me ask you about the damages that flow from the misrepresentation, because one of the things that trouble me about the briefs from both parties is no one really discussed the concept of pecuniary loss and what it meant and defined it for the court. And so when I went back to look at pecuniary loss and how that's defined and went to the stats annotated, I came up with the case of Pliss versus Peppertree Resort Villas, 264 with second 735. And admittedly, it discusses 100 120.5 and 100.18 violations. And it discusses ATCP 121. But when it talks about pecuniary loss, it's in that context, in paragraph 21, it says it's not any lost referral compensation, but rather the money paid for the product that the consumer was improperly induced into buying, due in part or in whole to the referral selling plan. And that involved a similar type action where you had some misrepresentations involved. So accordingly, since the uncontradicted complaint alleged that they were induced into buying a timeshare because of the referral selling plan, the trial court properly ruled that Pliss and Phelps suffered a loss in the amount that they actually paid for the timeshare. Now, when I look at that case and I apply that definition of pecuniary loss, why does that not apply under these circumstances, under these facts?
It can apply, but in a limited sense. It can apply in terms of the jury, again, was given the opportunity to say what damages flow from the misrepresentation. Your pecuniary loss was determined by the jury to be 25% of the damages. The important thing is...
But I guess the gist of my question, as I understood the way it was discussed in Pliss, is that if the misrepresentation induced the contract to put the parties back to where they would be, you would go back to before there was the contract for remodeling, because it was the contract for remodeling that was induced. So when I'm looking at the flow of damages, if I'm applying this case properly, and admittedly I may not be, but I'm just looking at the case and how it might apply here, it would seem that you have to go back and you have to look at where the parties would have been had there been no remodeling contract. Am I looking at that wrong?
You're looking at it far too broad, with all respect, Justice Butler, because there has to be a logical stopping point. Otherwise, to this day, the Stewarts are still suffering damages. And if the Stewarts, and I don't wish them ill, but let's assume their car is vandalized in the parking lot while they're sitting here, arguably that flows from the fact that they originally entered into the contract with Weisflog, otherwise they would never be at the Supreme Court. So the court has to establish a guide whereby a jury can determine these are the only damages that logically flow from the misrepresentation. Properly, the jury in the Stewart case did exactly that despite all the complications. The jury gave us that information, and it's important that this court accept that information from the jury and not have it be replaced by the Court of Appeals. I recognize what the Court of Appeals was doing. The Court of Appeals saying, well, we think all damages flow from this, but that's not the role of the Court of Appeals. That's the role of the jury. And fortunately, in this case, the jury heard all the evidence, heard the same arguments about terrible misrepresentations, bad construction, and they made that distinction. Now, I appreciate the fact that there is a question as to, all right, well, what about the damages in the relationship? But I think this verdict makes sense. I think it's logical, and I think it's supported by the evidence.
But doesn't this court have to, in effect, say, is the issue of apportionment a question of law? That's what the Court of Appeals said. And it's a question of law, and therefore we say no apportionment in this case. Jury verdict gone. Or is this apportionment a question of fact, because it's allowed under the law, therefore you support the jury verdict, which raises my whole other issue that seems to me you argued in your brief, although you argued the apportionment issue, that this is the verdict here should be zero because statute of limitations is gone, right?
Correct.
The economic loss doctrine means that you
Correct.
Get zero at the et cetera, right? So are you giving up those arguments?
Not at least, but okay. I recognize the important role that this court serves. The courts, future courts and juries are not going to care about the specific facts of Stewart. They are going to be concerned with what guidance this court gives them. I agree. The Stewart verdict should have come back zero. The claims are barred by the economic loss doctrine, barred by the statute of limitations, but in the
The jury was never asked that. Those are questions
right.
of law.
I agree. But in the big picture, the important thing that this court has to do is allow a jury, future juries, to say, these are the following damages that reasonably flow from the misrepresentation. These are the damages that are due to just bad construction. That's what the Stewart case did, and I would respectfully request that this court uphold what the jury do. And my time's out.
Unless we say zero.
I'd like zero.
Okay, thank you. Thank you, counsel. You have 5 minutes in rebuttal, Mr. Ratzel.
My name is Lori Levinsky. I am here representing the Wisconsin Builders Association. The Wisconsin Builders Association, like Weisflow, believes that that the decision by the Court of Appeals will have significant adverse consequences for the home remodeling industry. And we're not just talking about remodelers, but we're talking about consumers as well. We believe that the analysis that we've offered in our amicus brief is one that harmonizes the law rather than creates arbitrary lines that don't recognize the common law obligations contractors and remodelers have under existing common law. We believe our approach imposes the legislatively sanctioned remedies on those who do deceive, whereas it also keeps in line the common law doctrines of negligence and breach of contract and recognizes that these are distinct claims. So let me address very briefly what we believe the Court of Appeals did wrong. First, we believe that the plaintiff...
Ms. Levinsky, why don't you tell us first what your approach is? Why don't you summarize that for us?
Our approach is that the Court should recognize that the statutory claim for a misrepresentation in this case is a discrete claim from the negligence claim. And once the Court makes that recommendation, then we believe that nearly all, if not all, of the decisions this Court needs to make will flow directly from that distinction. So from that distinction, for example, we have, as the justices have noted, we have negligence claims, negligence design, negligence construction. And the analysis on that claim should be one where the Court needs to look at, okay, does the economic loss doctrine apply? We have here clearly a contract between two parties. We have a precedent that this Supreme Court has set, most recently in the Van Buren case from 2006, where the Court has said that if there is a contract between two parties, where the predominant purpose of which is for a product, in this case clearly one for a product, one for a home remodeling project, that the economic loss doctrine bars those negligence claims. And so in terms of the questions that you've offered earlier about, okay, what should the trial court have done? What, if we remand this back, what's this verdict going to look like? The Wisconsin Builders Association submits that the verdict, if you choose to remand it, should be and will be much cleaner than it was, because there will be no negligence questions. The negligence questions are barred by the economic loss.
Counsel, let me ask you about that, because we have one of the things that, as I understand the economic loss doctrine, that it does is it encourages the parties to, by contract, allocate the various responsibilities. That's the whole point. And in this case, you have the parties that actually did that, and they came up with two contracts. One, the architectural design, which looks, smells like a service contract, and one, the remodeling contract, which I think can be strongly argued is for a product based on some of the recent decisions of this court. So when I look at the economic loss doctrine, and I understand that you really can't apply it because it deals with tort and contract remedies, not statutory remedies, it seems that the economic loss doctrine does not apply to the statutory claim. I think an argument can be made that the Cease Electric may control the negligence in design claim with respect to the architectural contract. So you're looking at the other line of cases, the Van Buren, Linden, and that will control the line of cases with respect to the remodeling contract. So it does seem to make a difference whether you're talking negligence in design versus negligence in construction or remodeling. And I'm not sure the economic loss doctrine is broad enough to cover all three actions or even two of the three actions.
We would concede that the economic loss doctrine doesn't bar the statutory claim. And I think that's a separate analysis in terms of the remand issues and what the verdict should or should not have said. With respect to the negligent design and construction, as we submitted in our briefs to this court, the home remodeling industry often involves a contractor who first provides the plans, and then, in fact, in this case, the fee paid for those plans was, in fact, reduced from the contract price. And so I would submit that I think the court, rather than looking at is there one or two contracts or is there just one contract or did they create one contract and then amend it to include the construction, that you should look at the party's contractual relationship.
But isn't the whole point of the doctrine to encourage the parties to make those decisions? And if the parties sit down and make a decision that we're going to have a contract for design and we're going to have a contract for construction, that's your client's decision to make and not this court's.
Indeed it is. That is the basis for the doctrine. And in fact, these two parties in this case sat down and had contract number one for design and specified, hey, if you like this design, then we will, in fact, apply the fee to the construction claim and subsequently entered into a construction claim, or into a construction contract, excuse me. So you're right in the sense that the parties are, the basis for the whole doctrine itself is to encourage parties to contractually deal with what's going to happen. What happened in this case is that the parties' contractual relationship clearly involved from the get-go the design of a remodeling project that was subsequently altered and amended to include a very quite an expensive home remodeling project that clearly was the predominant purpose for the parties' contractual relationship.
I want to go back.
Before you leave, if I could ask you, if then the first contract was $1,500 to design this home improvement, if the Stewarts had decided they didn't like the design or maybe they got a design from a competing builder and chose that, then that would have been the end of the relationship. They would have paid $1,500 and that was it.
True.
Okay. All right. Just so I understand.
And if they didn't use the design, of course, they wouldn't have damages because they didn't use the design.
Sure.
Let me follow up on Justice Crooks's question. As I read your brief, I thought the underlying theme here is this is all negligence construction, breach of warranty, contract. Right? And I didn't see in the brief, which is I think what Justice Crooks was driving at, any recognition that there was misrepresentation here. And if so, what it was and whether it flowed into any damages. And so how do you, in your brief, distinguish between misrepresentation, jury found misrepresentation, and negligence? That's what you're asking, but you don't give any test, as I see the brief.
We believe the test is as articulated in the NARI brief, the other amicus brief that was supplied to the court. I believe there were actually three amicus. But they supplied the court with the analysis that you need to look at the statutory framework for the 100.20 sub 5 claim, and you need to look at what damages are because of the misrepresentation. Clearly the jury did find there was a misrepresentation, and we're not here to argue there wasn't.
Okay.
The jury would then need to be asked.
And so you think there's a 25% because of here?
I think that we believe that is one appropriate way for a trial court to address when you have damages like those that were presented in this case. That is one appropriate way for the trial court to address to the jury and to allow the jury how to apportion it. Another appropriate way would have been for the trial court to say, okay, here's the representation. What are the damages that flow from that? Here's the negligence. What are the damages that flow from that?
But
and given an instruction not to duplicate.
I really understand your argument, and you go to the NARI brief. The NARI brief says because of means very limited because of. It's for the absolute reason. It doesn't mean related to. Isn't that the NARI brief?
That is correct, okay. And that's our position.
That's your position. And so your position here, I think, would be, except for the jury verdict, that in this case, none of these damages are because of the misrepresentation. They are all caused by negligent construction.
It appears that if you take the liberal view of what because of is, that
well,
the
let's take the NARI view. Is that liberal, strict,
no,
reasonable,
I think it's a reasonable
something
view.
In between? Okay.
I think it's a reasonable view, and I think the jury is going to have to be asked what damages are because of. And I think the jury can be told what that means and decide based on the damages.
Did the jury instructions define because of for them?
I'm sorry?
Did the jury instructions define because of?
I do not believe so. If I'm not
objections
mistaken,
to that
the parties could probably
instruction.
Better answer
okay.
that.
Thank you.
Thank
That's
you.
A good comment. Oh, sorry.
Did they give a straight 1500 cause, a cause of the damages? Do you know jury instruction 1500? That's, if you don't know, that's okay. I want to follow up with that.
I don't know okay. the answer to your question.
But it leads into what my real question is, and that is the jury found in the special verdict that, let's say, the Ag 110 violation was a cause of damages. And we see that that's a traditional wording. It comes from the jury instruction 1500 cause. What would have happened here in this case in terms of damages presented and testimony presented if the only cause of action, one cause of action, violation of Ag 110, specifically a violation of Ag 110 regarding making a false statement to induce another person to enter a home and improvement contract. That's the only allegation. It was a cause of the damages. Plaintiff suffered damages. And so then you have the expert witness come in and say, pecuniary loss, the amount of $95,000. It seems to me that that could have been pled and tried that way.
It could have been. It would depend on how the trial court ruled on motions in limine with respect to what damages are because of that violation.
Well, and see, my point is a cause. You know, that's our jurisprudence. That's the not only our usual causation jurisprudence, but that's the way the jury, the special verdict was fashioned here, a cause of.
1500 was the instruction.
Yeah. Which comports with the norm. I mean, you don't, you know, it doesn't have to be the only cause. It doesn't have to be the cause. You know, it is a cause. And unless there's contributory negligence, which at least doesn't enter into the picture right now, if it is a cause, and then you ask, what's the loss here? The words of the statute or the code are a pecuniary loss. So do you have any, it seems to me that they would put on damages if the pecuniary loss of $95,000, and that's what they would get.
And we disagree with that approach, and I want to be clear
about this.
Yeah,
but tell me
this.
Why I'm wrong.
Because we do not believe that the Home Improvement Act attempted or is designed to basically supplant the common law. And by saying that all damages that are because of, for example, a beam that was – I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Thank you.
What I'm trying to articulate is that there is a difference between negligent construction claims and a misrepresentation claim. And the trial court would have had to sort through that and look at these expert reports and say, okay, what are you claiming is wrong with this house?
One of my problems is this, that the ag codes are this neat fabric, kind of warped at times, but nevertheless a neat fabric. And you have things like Justice Butler was referring to, I think it was Ag 121, and that might deal with timeshares. And it has language, and there's a lot of common language in the Ag codes, and it deals with the same type of stuff, that we have the very wording in 110, sub 11 that we've been talking about, make representation, false, deceptive, or misleading representations in order to induce. That's the language here. That's the language, I believe, in the timeshare. We have the Binkowski case in mobile homes, and sure enough, mobile homes has the same thing, 125.09. Make any false, deceptive, or misleading representation to induce a mobile home sale. So my sense is those cases, Binkowski with mobile homes, lists with timeshares that have the same language,
are informative of how we deal with damages, pecuniary damages.
I think they are informative. I think the court needs to look at, and in a remand order, if that's what the court chooses, to instruct the court, the trial court, that the court, trial court must decide what claimed damages relate to false, deceptive, or misleading representations that were designed or intended to induce.
I'm at a loss because I have not, unlike my colleague, read the Fliss case, but my understanding of it is that it almost ties into this a cause of concept that I started my questioning with. And I have to read the case, but that's what I heard from his question and his quote of the case, that the damages under Fliss, interpreting a different ag code with the same language as in this ag code as in other ag codes, would be broader than you would want.
And I would agree with what Attorney Ratzel said earlier with respect to how far that goes. And how far we stretch, you know, if there's a misrepresentation about, for example, the start date or end date of a contract, or, you know, not failure to provide an insurance policy, one could argue that, okay, if you would have changed the start date or end date, you never would have entered into this contract, and that all damages relating to a faulty construction thereafter flow therefrom.
And causation. That's the problem. You know, not every violation causes damages.
Correct. And that's, I think, what the trial court is going to have to instruct the jury to do in terms of looking at what misrepresentations, what false or deceptive statements did, in fact, induce the plaintiffs and cause them damage. And clearly that wasn't specifically addressed in the special verdict form.
What would you describe as the false, or what would you describe as the misrepresentation?
In this particular case, I guess I would leave that more to the parties to address. The Wisconsin Builders Association is more concerned with the broad-based impact, but I believe the misrepresentation that was claimed in this case related specifically to representations that Weisflow made concerning his abilities, concerning his construction experience. It might have been, I don't know the precise details, so I can't answer your question directly. But clearly the jury would have to determine, given those alleged false statements, whether those were made to induce the plaintiffs to enter into the contract and those were made to cause them damage due to the because of language.
Thank you, counsel. We'll now hear from Attorney Roy E. Wagner representing the Stewarts. Mr. Wagner.
May it please the court, my name is Roy Wagner, and I'm here on behalf of Robert and Lynn Stewart, or here in present court. I'm going to skip my introduction because I think I can provide an example which will bookend Justice Bradley's questions about the misrepresentation flowing, Justice Butler's question about pecuniary damages, and I think, quite frankly, this verdict in this case is salvageable in its same form if we identify one error that the trial court made. And if I could use this example. In this case, the pecuniary damages are, in fact, defined, Justice Butler, in Benkowski. They are gleaned to be contract in nature, that being that you get the benefit of the bargain. So what happened in this case is the Stewarts bargained for an addition that was, you know, complete and fine and fit when it was done. They did not get that. The pecuniary damages that were presented in the facts by both sides, the pecuniary damages, was one solution and one solution only. Demolish and rebuild. Demolish and rebuild. So the pecuniary damages in this case was that solution offered by the Weisflow's contractor, who said, you can't salvage this thing. It's rotten to the core. By the Stewart's expert witness, who said, you can't salvage this. It's rotten to the core. It needs to come down and you need to start over. So in the Stewart case, the pecuniary damages are demolition and rebuilding. That was the only evidence of damages presented at all.
And how much was that? What's the range of the damages?
Your Honor, in fact, what happened is that our witness on cross-examination at record 85753 conceded 95,000.
Okay, so 95 is what the expert testimony showed then?
That was our expert, after examination. Now, there was a range, and obviously I tried to get more, as I argued in front of the jury, but I believe, in spite of what Justice Abramson is saying, if I try to infer your logic is, did we only get part of the pie from out of this jury?
Exactly what I was asking.
I'm going to concede that we got all of the pie. That is, inartfully, as that question is asked, it is bad. I think all of the damages were there because the only damage testimony presented by both sides in the pecuniary damage was demolished and rebuilt. Okay, now I want to back up to what Justice Bradley was asking before. Can we have a case where misrepresentation causes, in this case, the pecuniary damages of demolish and rebuild? And then in this case, the answer is yes. And the reason is, the reason things need to be demolished is it rotted. Everybody testified. It's uncontroverted. The reason it rotted was because of the code violations. The floor joists were unventilated, they were untreated, they were 8 inches above the dirt, and those are four code violations that caused the rot. So there was a cause. This cause was the code violations. There is no testimony to the contrary as to why that building rotted and needed to be torn down. Now, the misrepresentation that we alluded to in our opening statement throughout the case in every single brief was the following. Ron Weisflow, when he hooked up with the Stewarts, said to them, I'm going to give you architectural quality services, and I promise to build and design to comply with the building code.
Counselor, were there any inspections of this product by the city building inspector while it was going on?
I'm sure it was, Your Honor. I've always argued that I argued emotion limited at the trial court, but building inspections are to deter compliance like police officers are supposed to deter speeding.
Right.
But in this case, the rotting was caused by the very fact that the Stewarts relied on, and that was it would comply with the building code. So I'd like to suggest in this case the error that the court made being overly sensitized to the issue of doubling too many damages, it leapfrogged over the evidence. And what it did is it leapfrogged over the very fact that the pecuniary damages in this case was one flavor, demolish and rebuild. There wasn't one scintilla of evidence that said, oh, what's it going to cost to add another joist? Nobody said that. And the reason that we think it's irrelevant and this jury verdict is salvageable is because when you demolish and rebuild in addition, the good work, the bad work, the deceptive work is all captured in one wrecking ball. And there was no need for this jury to look at dividing this up. So the error in this trial that has flowed through and spawned today's discussion is the following. The judge, being overly concerned about doubling too much, added 16, and it should never have been there at all because it forced this jury to speculate.
Mr. Wagner, let me ask you, did you object to question 16?
Yes. In fact, if you look in all of my briefs, the entire objection is in there where I said that it forced the jury to speculate, and I raised the policy issues that we raised in our briefs that it would offend.
You objected at trial court?
Yes.
In response to Justice Crooks?
Yes.
There are two contracts here?
Yes.
And were there misrepresentations to induce the Stewarts to enter into the first contract?
Your Honor, the answer is yes. And that occurred in the following manner. The contract says they're going to provide architectural services. We argued to the trial court that Chapter 443 of the statutes doesn't allow anybody who's not an architect to use the derivative of that word. He was not an architect. He also said he would design and build to architectural quality. We had an expert witness who said he did not. And so we believe those were misrepresentations. We believe they were in the inducement.
Is that architectural contract a home improvement contract?
I contend it is because it's for the improvement of a home.
Did the misrepresentation induce the second contract? I mean, if you say the misrepresentation just induced the first contract, which was the 1500 or 1000, whichever it is, then maybe your damages are only 1500 and 1000. That was, I think, a question was asked, and that may be the implication. Was the misrepresentation, did it induce the second contract too?
Yes, Your Honor. Chief Justice, he was asked the following. Would you build do you promise to build according to the code? And he said yes. The first contract for his design, where he said he was going to design and provide architectural services. Similarly, he was asked the question, I can provide the site, will you build, do you promise to build according to the building code? And he said yes, affirmatively.
But the jury found there was no misrepresentation in regard to his being a licensed architect, right?
I had a struggle, Your Honor, with the trial court on this issue, and it came about in chambers where defense counsel raised the fact that you don't need to be an architect to design a residence, unlicensed, okay? And I could not get the trial court to include that in there because somehow it thought this was a safe harbor. But Chapter 443, which was my argument to the trial court, was that it's improper for anybody to use a derivative of the word architecture if you're not licensed. And so I had our expert architect said that he performed architectural services poorly.
Are architects subject to Ag 110?
Obviously, it's not a question in this case. As a policy matter, I'd have to think about it. If they're providing architectural services, I think they might have disclosure requirements and the like in their contract. I have to think about that more, Justice Prosser.
I represent
a lot of architects.
If architects are designing an improvement, I asked you whether the architectural contract was subject to 110, and you said whether it was a home improvement contract, you said it was because it's an improvement.
The 110.02.11 talks about no seller. 110.02, no seller. And then 110.015 defines seller as a person engaged in the business of making or selling home improvements.
Or services. We keep going, the word
includes
services.
Includes corporations, and any other form of business organization. It doesn't say services, and at least what I have is 110.015 here. But maybe I don't have the whole thing, and maybe there's another provision.
I would be glad to brief that. I brief that in other matters, Your Honor.
No problem.
You may be thinking warranty, because that includes services. The next section, sub-6. Mm-hmm.
What I'd like to do, perhaps, for this Court is make the final point with my facts, if I could, or unless Justice Prosser has a question.
He does.
I have no problem at all about being disturbed by the conduct of the defendants. I have no problem at all in trying to arrive at a fair judgment. I do have some problems along the way in attributing everything that flows from some kind of misrepresentation into pecuniary or monetary damages. For example, we had a case a couple of years ago that involved medical malpractice after an accident. In this case, Mr. Stewart put his foot through the floor, and I think the evidence also shows there was mold. Suppose he broke his leg, and then there was medical malpractice in treating the leg. Does that all flow from a misrepresentation? It seems to me there are cases that talk about a nexus causation, I believe the phrase was, or causation nexus, whichever it was. And I'm having trouble linking all of this under the statute and code.
I think you have my outline, Your Honor. My next point would be the following, is that if we go back to Justice Butler's question about pecuniary damages, is it's to put you in the same position you should have been. So the stewards should get money that would give them a solid structure, which is the $95,000. So I don't think a broken leg would apply under the Home Improvement Act or 100.20. The next point is, I think there is a legal framework in place to deal with the code and the non-code violations.
Counsel, I'd like to add, I know you want to launch into that, but I have a question about that. And it kind of goes to the heart of the issue of the statute of limitations. And I know you've argued 89352, and I understand how that argument weighs with respect to the remodeling issue. But we also have the ATCP issue, and we have the negligent design claim. I'm not, the negligent design claim seems very problematic. I'm not sure how I see that at all. But with respect to the ATCP claim, it seems that this statute, unless I'm misreading it, doesn't control that. And so I go back and I look at the statute of limitations, the general statute, and I think, and I want you to tell me if I'm wrong when I do this, because this really wasn't stressed in your brief, but it seems to be that we're looking at 893.93(1), either A or B. And I'm not clear which it would be with respect to the statutory claim. And with B, obviously, that gets you where you want to be, because if it's an action for fraud, that gets you the discovery line. But should it be A? Has this court or has the Court of Appeals ever applied the discovery rule with respect to Section 1A?
Just as a preamble, the only issues the parties briefed was whether the contract statute of limitations applied. The amicus brief asked about the two-year statute, and we haven't fully briefed that. I'm prepared to answer the question, but I don't think it's properly before the court. However, to answer your question, Justice, we say that ATCP violations are negligence per se. As a negligence, because it's a defined conduct.
Brief that.
Okay. Protected interest, and because of that, it's subject to the discovery rule. In the facts in this case, I think we can put the statute limits to bed for any and all statute that could possibly rain down upon the Stewarts. We filed the lawsuit in the spring of 2003, and we know that they finished the work in the fall of 2007. So that's the sixth year. We discovered it in the fall of 2001 and filed the lawsuit in the spring of 2003. So that's 18 months. So that's the two-year.
I guess my question goes to, should this court disagree with your argument that this constitutes negligence per se for purposes of the statute of limitations? It would seem to me that we're back to 893.93, either 1A or B. And I understand that B gets you where you want to be. My question goes to 1A. If 1A applies, if you know, and if you don't know, fine, we'll look it up. But does the discovery rule, has that ever been applied by either this court or the Court of Appeals with respect to violations of 893.93(1A)?
I don't know that. I do know that if this is a tort, Your Honor, we have the discovery rule, and I believe this is a tort.
Well, the statutory claim is different. I think the parties disagree right on what that means, but as I see it, you have a statutory claim that's neither a contract nor a court. It's a claim that was created by the legislature to deal with this level of misrepresentation.
And I think what it is, it's a remedial statute that's meant to show that we have prohibited conduct. It fits squarely, we believe, under the negligence per se cases as to what we're talking about. Is it's a prescribed conduct for a specific class intended to protect them. And so that's what we would argue, that as such, it's negligence per se.
Counselor, when you say that the 893.93 questions that Justice Butler is asking aren't before the court because the amicus briefed it, but the parties did not, do you know if there was any request by any party to file a response to the amicus?
I know of none, Your Honor.
You don't know of any? No. Okay, thank you.
Counsel, as I understand your argument, though, even if it's 893.93(1A), which allows for 6 years after the cause of action accrues an action upon a liability created by statute when a different limitation is not prescribed by law, that your argument as set forth in your brief is that this was within a 6-year period of limitations because of the filing in the spring of 2003 and completing the work in the fall of 97, I guess.
Right. And 18 months of discovery, so I thought we were home free.
Do you think that the discovery applies to the 2-year statute of limitations? I mean, is that how you get the 18 months?
Well, we filed it because we wanted to file it and get the case going. We didn't file it based upon our calendar and looking at that, Your Honor.
Thank you.
Under the ATCP, a private individual can sue like an attorney general, right?
Right.
And so it's a private party that's pursuing the statutory penalty.
Right.
How do you define statute penalty under 2A, 893.93(2A)? Why doesn't this fit that analysis?
I'm going to beg off, Your Honor, not only because this was an amicus argument that was raised that we did not respond to and we did not think it was appropriate. So if the Court is interested in briefing in that, I would be glad to provide that, but I don't have the answer. We understand that the statutory penalty would be such that it would be punitive in nature. We believe this statute is remedial in nature and meant to compensate the stewards for their wrong.
Double damages is not punitive.
Well, they're essentially doing it as private attorney generals. I mean, these are prosecutable crimes, and they're encouraged to do this, and that is the encouragement. If I could lay the landscape as to why we think the facts in this case, and secondly, the apportionment is salvageable, we would offer this example. We think that if we take Justice Bradley's example where we just have a misrepresentation that can it cause all damages, I think we can use three examples to show how in this framework the apportionment issue should work. We use in the brief where they talked about the start and finish date. If my clients were promised a finish date by January 1 and got in February 1 and there was no notice of impending delay as the code requires, they might be able to double their hotel bill, because that would be the damages because of the pecuniary damages because of the violation, as the statute says. Similarly, if we use the example of the floor joist, let's say there's no other problem except for two. The floor joist rotted. They were promised to comply with code. They don't comply with code. In that situation, if that's all we're talking about, that's a misrepresentation that goes to the heart. The structure must be demolished and rebuilt. Those are pecuniary damages because of the violation, or as the Court of Appeals says, follows or contributes to, or under normal tort laws says substantial factor. We think all of those terms are sympathetic and consistent. But if we get to that situation which we have at hand, and that's the following. We have the example used over and over again about what about that double joist? It's in there. It should have been two and it was only one. Well, the question is, does because of the misrepresentation, do the stewards get all of the pecuniary damages to demolish and repair, even though there is negligence? And that's a jury question under the right circumstances if, as we would argue, and Justice Abramson pointed out, there are plenty of fact situations where juries regularly are asked to make this sort of analysis. But in this case, because demolition and remodeling wiped out the entire structure, the misrepresentation code problem, which caused the structure to be rotted and to have the double joist and single joist all come down with the wrecking ball, the answer would be yes, Justice Walsh. There can be misrepresentations that overlay other wrongdoings, and it's because of the violation, the code, that causes them to superimpose and become such a factor that when they're mixed and are indivisible and cannot be divided, we would suggest to this Court that under those circumstances, the damages cannot be bisected as the parties would have. And I can provide...
The violation of the code was that they didn't build according to the building code. Is that right?
That was the overt representation.
Doesn't every building contract say if it doesn't say it, isn't it implicit that it's going to be built according to the code?
Yes, well, it may, Your Honor, if I understand your example, and I'd like to answer it. The way I would answer that is the Home Improvement Act says false, deceptive, or misleading. Now, if we have some guy who just has a bad day, and he picks up the wrong size joist, he's supposed to have 2x10s, and he picks up a 2x8, the question is, for the jury, is that false, deceptive, or misleading? In this situation, I asked Mr. Weisflow, did you promise? He said yes. And then I asked him, did you know there was a code for venting dryers through the attic? No, never knew it. Did you ever read the code? No. Did you know there was a Brookfield code? No. So the jury would then be asked, was that false, deceptive, or misleading? And the answer is yes. So I don't think we have to worry about the sky is falling arguments, Justice Abrahamson, by the building industry that somehow the Home Improvement Act is going to fall upon them every contractual sin. It will still always be a jury question as to whether or not it was false or deceptive. If the contractor picks up the wrong joist and puts it in there, and his contractor says 2x10s and he does a 2x8, I don't think there's a jury that's going to find that was false or deceptive.
Well, suppose he agrees, the building contractor agrees to build according to code, and then knows the code, has it, and then decides he's going to do it a little cheaper than the code and doesn't follow the code. Do you view that as false, deceptive, misleading? When he does it, I'm assuming he doesn't do it the entire construction, but does it hither and yon.
If you could show Justice Abramson that the contractor makes a decision to fatten his wallet at the expense of the homeowner.
During the construction. Not at the initial contract.
I think you could argue a couple of code violations. One would be that it's false or deceptive. There's another code violation that says you can't demand money for services you promised to deliver. You could also have the bait and switch allegation. There is an entire litany of code violations that could apply to that situation where you have a contractor who decides to put his interest above the homeowner. Because what we need to realize both under the apportionment issue, the economic loss issue, as well as the statute of limitation. This is a remedial statute that the legislature has deemed that on a bargaining playing field, the Stewarts and others like them are at a distinct disadvantage. We need to remember that we are not regular purchasers of construction services. We are irregular.
Counselor, I'd like you just to focus your attention when you answer this question on the second contract, the construction contract. And I'd like you to tell me whether you think 1325 Van Buren Avenue, which is a case written by Justice Wilcox, has any bearing on whether the economic loss doctrine would bar tort damages under that particular contract.
In this fact situation?
Yes.
In our case?
Yep.
And the answer is no.
Why?
The answer is no because in this case, we are alleging code violations under the ATCP. We think under the Kalin case says that there has been a legislative choice that has predominant, that it says, in fact, under 118, which is a cousin, which has very similar language to the false, deceptive, and misleading language under ATCP 0211, which where this language comes from, is virtually identical to the 118 language from Kalin, we would argue that there is a legislative choice that these are a protected status as consumers, and therefore, if one of the tenets of the economic loss doctrine is that parties are on an equal playing field, the legislature has made the decision that this is not a common law
issue. Counselor, I don't have a quarrel with that, but the special verdict talks about negligence. And the case appears to have been tried on two theories, a violation of ATCP and negligence violations. And apparently the lack of a double joist where the plans call for a double joist is argued to us to be negligence by the contractor. And so I'm wondering how you get around the predominant purpose test that was employed in a remodeling contract, which is the 1325 Van Buren case,
yes,
for the negligence claims that show up in the special verdict and apparently were tried.
Your Honor, first, I think that, number one, we need to remember there are two contracts here.
And I want you to focus on the second.
I understand.
Okay.
And I don't think the predominant purpose test applies when you have two contracts, one versus the other. If we ignore the fact that we have a misrepresentation service contract from which all the damages could flow, and we isolate the fact that we have some isolated misrepresentation damages and some isolated negligence damages.
Okay.
Under those circumstances, I would be hard-pressed to argue that if those negligence damages are purely isolated and directly related to the work under the contract, they would not necessarily be, they could be susceptible to the economic loss doctrine.
Mr. Wagner, if I can follow up Justice Rogan's last question, because I'm having the same problem. I accept your argument that there are two contracts here, and her question went specifically to the second contract and the second contract only. So in dealing with the second contract and not trying to bring in the first, second contract only, I guess the question once again becomes, does 1325 Van Buren or does Linden govern with respect to the economic loss doctrine, at least with respect to the negligence claims for construction?
If we forget about my initial argument that the pecuniary damages flow from the negligence, I'm sorry, from the misrepresentation in this case.
Yeah, that's a separate, I understand that. I'm just talking about negligence.
Right. But if we had, again, purely negligence damages, okay, that flow strictly from the performance of the contract, I would be hard-pressed to argue that the economic loss doctrine for that would not apply. I can envision, you know, lots of fact situations where, in fact, you have a contract for a remodeling contractor that would, in fact, there could be negligence claims against them. Assuming there are no overlaying home improvement claims, which are those protected claims and not part of common law, I believe that the economic loss doctrine could deter pure negligence claims that are not commingled, if you will, with Home Improvement Act violations. If there is any commingling, I would counsel the court to saying that that's a requirement and a burden that shifts to the defendants at that point to untangle the damages for the fact finder to decide.
Well, what about fraud and inducement for the second contract?
I'm sorry?
What about the concept of fraud in the inducement for the second contract? Was there fraud? Is it your position there was fraud in the inducement for the second contract?
Your Honor, if we look at the way the court obviously has taken the narrow view of the fraud and the inducement. You want me to go ahead?
I think so. I think the alarm system has a problem today. I don't know all the facts, but that's there we go.
There we go.
Okay.
Your Honor, one of the questions that the jury was asked, of course, is did the remodeling contractor make false deceptive in order to induce them to enter into the remodeling contract? So the answer is there's a jury verdict question about false, deceptive, and misleading, which, of course, is a code violation. I don't think it fits exactly the intentional misrepresentation that this Court has carved out as under the economic loss doctrine. However, I would propose and suggest the following, that an extension of the economic loss doctrine, fraud in the inducement exception, may be warranted in this case and under these circumstances. And that's as follows. While we don't comply with the code compliance with the intentional misrepresentation elements that the Court has laid out, we do, however, in fact, have a legislative choice that there is a disadvantaged class of citizens that need protection, hence the Home Improvement Act. We do have a misrepresentation that was induced our clients to enter into the contract. While the Court has said, I believe in K&S Tool this summer most recently, that under 118, reliance is not necessarily a factor, What the court said in that decision was insightful, that if there is reliance, there is inducement. And in fact, in this case, Judge Haney required a reliance question in the verdict, which in hindsight is unnecessary because of this code violation doesn't have a reliance component. So the jury did answer that question. Was there reliance? And the answer in all cases was yes. So now we have inducement. And so if we have a statutory misrepresentation in the inducement to a protected class, I would proffer to this court, this is an appropriate block to the economic loss doctrine being applied in this landscape, in these facts, and in this situation.
Simply put, you're saying that the statute trumps the judicial doctrine of economic loss doctrine.
Yeah. I went a long way around the block, but Kalin, I think, says the same thing.
If the Stewarts would have taken the first architectural contract and contracted with someone else to do the remodeling work, how do you think the economic loss doctrine would apply with respect to that second contractor if they did the same kind of work?
I think they would be suing Weisflow for his poor design if the guy followed the design to the T. Okay. If the contractor had a contract to perform and he didn't perform the contract, I'd be suing the contractor for breach of contract.
Okay,
if you look at this contract, you know, it has a very specific, I'm going to do this, that, or the other, and it's very menu-like without business terms.
Because 1325 Van Buren would apply to the second contract.
Correct.
And the other contractor. Would Weisflog then be responsible for the damages if the second contractor did faulty workmanship and negligent work?
I don't think Weisflow as a designer would be responsible for the poor workmanship. I do think that if the workman had blinders on and, you know, followed his poor drawings, okay, I think, and, you know, for whatever reason they were told, build it exactly as he says, I don't care what you see there. I think you would be able to go to Weisflow and say, I'm going to sue you for your negligence, okay, because you have a regular negligence claim. If, in fact, it came under the Home Improvement Act and it was false and deceptive, you would have those claims that would flow from it. Because the pecuniary loss would be they should have got the benefit of the bargain, and that is a properly built structure from the design he was selling them. The benefit.
Chief, if I may.
Counsel.
I see in 16B the percentages of 25 and 75, and I'm sure the judge was saying, glad I didn't have to do that. Because I don't understand. I haven't read by any means the five-day record in this case right now. Was there any evidence to divide that this area of damages is attributable to representation as opposed to negligence? And if so, give me an example when you start out your oral argument with the admin. I listen to all oral arguments, but I always listen to the first 60 seconds because I think that's where people, you know, trying to impress us. And you had comments in there that go to this very question.
Your Honor, I'm going to read from the transcript, page 975. This is the defendant's expert.
Yeah, your comments were, this is all about, I think, destroy and
demolish.
Demolish and rebuild, yes.
Because I'm trying to capture that as the phrase, in this case, that is the pecuniary damages. Mm-hmm. The only ones testified to, and if I read Ben Moen's testimony, I'm just going to jump in at line 21 on page, I think it's 975. When I saw the floor joists were writing, I saw some mold on the inside of the existing concrete. There was some starting around the perimeter, windows area. Rather than try to look at repairing there, I felt that it was just to bear it down and rebuild it. So my point is the defendant's own expert didn't give any laundry list of what's to negligence and what's to any other choice. The pecuniary damage in this case was tear it down and rebuild it.
Counselor, whose obligation is it to provide any separation of damages if those separations were needed?
I go back to the case, I'm not sure I can pronounce properly, Firmenfredo, 174 with second. And that's where you have two tortfeasors, two doctors cause problems on one patient. They're in a better position than we are. And we would contend that if there are mixed damages, and I have examples if the court is interested, but if there are mixed damages, the defendant in that situation under common series of court law is in a better position to bifurcate and separate those for the jury. The burden would shift to them to separate that, and that was not done in this case.
So they have to prove up what damages were caused by each of your claims?
No. Well, what they would need to do is if they want to avoid the doubling, okay, they would have to provide evidence so the fact finder could say there were damages solely attributed to negligence that were not mixed in with code violations. And I would suggest a jury verdict question in the future that would say, you know, what amount of damages, what are the pecuniary damages? And there could be a jury instruction on that. And then the question that would next be asked is, the jury could be asked, do you feel that any of the damages in the previous question are as a result of negligence? If you answer the previous question, what amount of those damages are solely attributable to the negligence of the contractor? Solely. Because if they can't prove solely, and you've got a mixed bag there, I think in that situation, the remedial nature of the law should not require the plaintiff to untangle what the defendant has mixed up.
Did you ask or anybody ask for a question like that, what damages are attributable solely to negligence?
No, I tried to ward that off, Your Honor, by objecting to 16A and B, which I felt because the pecuniary damage in this case were tear it down and they flowed from the code and flowed from the misrepresentation, there was no need and I lost.
Thank you.
You're arguing on the burden of proof by analogy to these other cases.
Yes.
And you say, well, they want to apportion. Your job is to show damages.
Correct.
They want to apportion it out. It's their job to bring that burden.
Correct.
Okay, counsel, your red light's on. I don't see anybody else wanting to ask your question. Thank you. Mr. Ratzel.
I'll try to pick up on a couple of points. In answer to Chief Justice's question, the apportionment, it's going to be on the burden of whichever party wants the jury to answer in a certain fashion. So what was interesting is, in answer to Justice Bradley's question, yes, the jury did hear evidence of both poor workmanship and essentially misrepresentation. That was the focus of the entire trial. As counsel indicated, we didn't really have a defense. I was telling the jury in the opening argument, fix this house. So what the jury heard and could arguably say is the biggest problem was the hot tub room. This was a massive remodeling. Every other aspect of the house was fine, but at the last minute they decided to put this hot tub room out. Now, the jury could rightfully say there was misrepresentation because there was some poor planning, poor design, things like that. But the biggest problem with that hot tub room, as counsel just read from my expert, was it just was poorly built. It had nothing to do with misrepresentation, it was just bad work. Now, this becomes significant because look at the test now that's been established to represent a misrepresentation. The question is, a consumer goes to a home builder, are you going to do a good job for me? Are you going to comply with codes? The next question, after they read all these cases, the consumer is going to say, are you going to do anything negligent on the construction site? And, of course, the builder is always going to say, as part of marketing, no, I'm going to do a good job for you. Then it's a trap because the minute there's a punch list item, the minute there's a violation, it's off to the races with high attorney's fees and doubling the damages.
Counsel, do you agree that your client said he didn't even know there was a building code? That he didn't check it, comply with it? I mean, that's a lot different than saying I'm going to do a good job.
Well, but if I'm not mistaken, there's the son also testified, and the son is the one that signed the building contract. I could be wrong. I don't want to mislead the court. I thought the son testified that he wasn't aware there was a building code. I represent the father, and this raises a whole other question at this front of this court, is the individual exposure of the father. The son is the one that actually signed the building contract. So I'm trying to be direct, but for all...
Respondent.
Pardon me?
Who is Ronald who's being
Ronald
sued?
Ronald is the father.
The father, okay.
Robert signed the building contract, which is why when you get into the question of individual liability, that was one of the areas.
Ronald signed the architectural contract.
Correct. As president of the corporation, correct.
Well, he said president, but it doesn't ever say anywhere that it's the Weissflog Showroom Gallery, Inc., when you look at the signatures. And then the remodeling contract is signed by Robert, and that's not signed anywhere as Inc., and it's Weissflog Homes, and I didn't see anything that said Inc., although the architectural contract refers to the gallery as Inc. But the construction, the remodeling contract is with Weissflog Homes, which isn't shown as anything.
You're absolutely correct. You're absolutely correct. And this is all of the evidence that the jury heard, and that's why essentially the jury took it out on my client and said there was misrepresentation involved. But when it comes to trace what damage flowed from that misrepresentation, the project really was a result of bad workmanship. Counsel talks in terms of, well, this is a hot tub room, it has to be torn down. That's the remedy, but the jury was given the decision to what damage, in other words, was the need to tear down this hot tub room due to a misrepresentation, or do you have to tear it down because it's simply bad work?
Well, let's just change the fact situation for the heck of it and say that both Weissflogs here said they didn't know there was a building code.
Right.
They never attempted to fit the building code. They said they were going to comply with the building code, but they never even knew it or tried it. How would that case fit into this one? Would you say that there are double damages under the regulation?
The only damages that still would be doubled are those damages that flow from that misrepresentation. Essentially, what the hypothetical you're giving me is a stupid general contractor that misrepresents everything. Well, if that stupid general contractor does a great job, except for ordinary punch list items that you find at any construction site, no, you don't double all the damages on the punch list items, because that's the type of thing that is found at every construction site. That would be supplanting your ordinary breach of contract claim. If I'm a stupid contractor, but I hire the best plumber in the world, but that plumber uses a bad pipe, the damages shouldn't be doubled simply because I misrepresented that I might know how to construct buildings, because my misrepresentation did not cause or bring about that damage. That was due to your ordinary run-of-the-mill construction defect.
Give me an example of a misrepresentation that does cause damage.
A misrepresentation causes damage is that I'm going to put in the highest grade window that's going to keep water out, and it's going to have an insulating factor of R, whatever, 100. I turn around to save money, I put in Joe's windows, which are lousy windows and only last a year. In that case, the homeowner literally lost value. He lost money because he paid for expensive windows, he got cheap windows. There's a direct loss due to the misrepresentation. That's the purpose of the statute, because this legislature wants to shut down that type of construction. Now, if this is a large construction site like the Stewart project was, before the project even started, I could have said there will be punch list items. There will be things the electrician misses, the roofer misses, the landscaper misses, that you have to come back and fix them. However, a homeowner could sit there and say, no, I don't want to hear anything about punch lists. I'm running to my lawyer. I now have double damages, plus I get attorney's fees. His incentive, the consumer's incentive, is to bring a lawsuit. Because if he settles with the builder is going to say, fine, I'll fix your electrical outlet. But the homeowner is saying, wait a minute, if I start a lawsuit, that project gets doubled. Plus, the stain in the kitchen isn't what I wanted. Plus, the landscaper didn't put the bush where I wanted, and that bush died. And pretty soon, you are taking a simple construction site with a myriad of problems, and you are doubling the damages without linking the damage to the misrepresentation. And that, I think, is just fraught with peril.
Thank Counsel, you keep saying you, that if this were remanded, I gather you think that there's a possibility of remand. The attorney fees on this, according to the 30-page document, are roughly $200,000. Are you willing to be liable for, depending on how attorney fees are calculated, another couple $100,000 to remand this?
The attorney's fee issue is a classic indication of how this case is being driven, not by protecting the homeowner, but literally it's become a boom to attorneys. Because $260,000 to defend a case, my fees were 40-some-odd thousand dollars. The court properly identified in this case what reasonable fees were associated to the limited area of the misrepresentation.
Part of the record, counsel? Your fees part of the record?
I think they are. I think in response initially at the trial court, I think somehow that evidence got in.
Counselor, but there was another attorney. I mean, when I looked at the bill for opposing counsel's attorney's fees, a large part of it was to defend motions for summary judgment brought by the insurance company. You wouldn't have been in support of that because they were trying to get out from covering your clients, right?
Most of the attorney's fees, number one, they had two lawyers throughout the entire trial, but more importantly, they spent thousands of dollars on claims that ultimately they dismissed. This breach of contract claim that they litigated from day one, there was motions, there were summary judgment motions. I kept saying, stop the breach of contract. There's a statute of limitations problem. They would fight me every step of the way. There were hearings, depositions, things like that. The morning of trial, they dropped the claim. And then they say, you have to pay attorney's fees for my attempts to do things that ultimately I withdrew. So I think the trial court properly looked at the entire record and said, we're only going to award reasonable attorney's fees here.
Counsel, didn't the trial court go back, though, and impose a one-third based upon the damages? And as I understand it, there was no contingency contract in this case, correct?
My understanding is that the attorney had an hourly rate.
So understanding your argument that there was a lot of money spent in a lot of areas that should not have applied to this case,
right.
Did the trial court have an obligation to go back and look at the entire litigation and parcel out where the attorney's fees were spent in order to allocate reasonable attorney fees as opposed to just saying, okay, damages are X, we'll apply one-third?
I think the court could have adopted a number of different ways to compute what are reasonable attorney's fees. I recognize what the court did in this case was simply say, all right, there's only a portion of the damages were due to the misrepresentation. As a result, the court could only award attorney's fees for those damages that flow from the misrepresentation the way the law in the state of Wisconsin is. Otherwise, you're expanding the recovery of attorney's fees to a simple breach of contract action. So I think what the trial court did makes sense in light of what the jury did. Because the jury separated out and said most of the damages were not as a result of the act. As a result, the court saying, well, then most of the attorney's fees can't be a result of the act. And then the court simply said, all right, you recovered X amount of dollars. I'm assigning a contingency to that. I think that was a practical, logical way to look through the myriad of attorney's fees and come up with a reasonable amount. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Ratzel. I want to thank attorneys Ratzel, Lubinsky, and Wagner for their excellent arguments today in a very difficult case that presents not only tough legal issues, but presents factual issues and an issue about the special verdict. That concludes our hearing on 2005 AP 886, Stewart versus Weiss Flog Showroom Gallery, Inc. Counsel. And we will now move to the next case, which relates to this case, but different attorneys.